This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. A new book today, I'll be reading some excerpts from a book called Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology by Jeff Wilson, a Wisconsin biologist. Illustrations by Terry Dalton, and they're just wonderful. And reading from the back of the book, it says, during his 30-year career in wildlife management, Jeff Wilson found himself atop eagle nests, deep in bear dens, tracking fur bearers on snow-covered forest roads, and spending nights under the stars banding loons. His adventures or misadventures in wildlife biology are incredibly informative, entertaining, and occasionally hilarious. These stories communicate a deep passion for wildlife and its future in a changing world. Jeff Wilson currently spends his time between his island cabin on the Turtle Flambeau Flowage and Lake Superior, adventuring with his wife, artist, and illustrator Terry Dalton. And Terry Dalton, who did these terrific illustrations in this book, I love every one of them. Terry Dalton is an environmental educator and artist. She works in scratchboard, watercolor, pastels, and printmaking. Her artwork can be viewed at terrydaltonart.com. Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology is Jeff Wilson's first full-length book. It was published in 2022 by the Cornerstone Press in Stevens Point. I'll start reading the prologue. I was 40 feet up a massive white pine, my fingers gripping the rough bark. My feet felt secure, balanced on the metal tree-climbing spikes that buckled over my boots and around my calves. Just above my head were the first branches that would allow me handholds. So I released one side of my belt harness and let it hang as I reached to grab the lowest branch and heave myself up and into a sitting position on the limb. Glancing down far below, I could see the 12 field trippers and my eagle-banding partner, Bruce, peering up intently. Just past the crew, our boat stern peeked out from the willow shrubs lining the shore of Blair Lake. I could hear Bruce explaining the banding protocol, entertaining the group who had signed up for this tour with the Natural Resources Foundation. They expected a good show, and we would deliver. The group had been a rapt audience from the start. We'd gathered that morning at Springstead Landing, a boat launch on the Turtle Flambeau Flowage in northern Wisconsin. They'd watched the shores with interest during our circuitous boat ride, skirting islands and wetland channels. When I unpacked the climbing gear, demonstrating the harness around my waist and legs and how the flip belt would secure my progress up the trunk, they'd ask good questions. I even passed around my climbing spike so they could feel the sharp point that would stab into the bark and enable my ascent up the pine. Clearly, they found our risky occupation novel, if not a bit crazy, but to me this tree was like an old friend. I had grappled up to its 80-foot crown before, and now with the branchless section of the trunk behind me, I could relax a bit and enjoy the ascent. The nest was about 10 feet below the treetop in a thick fork. I climbed methodically until I was just below the nest, then strapped in with my flip belt again. This would allow me to maneuver safely around the bulky nest. It was a huge structure, 4 feet wide and 6 foot long. In particular, I needed both hands free in case there was a jumper, a chick with big ideas, who decided to test its wings a bit too early. I repositioned my spikes, edged up, and peeked over the rim of the nest. One chick hunched down, flat and motionless, but the other stood up, spread its wings, and hissed before retreating to the far corner of the nest bowl. I began a one-way conversation with them, murmuring in what I hoped was a soothing manner. As I slowly stretched up and halfway into the nest, I smiled to myself, gauging that the chicks were the perfect age for handling and banding, about 6 or 7 weeks. Most of their downy plumage was gone, and their primaries were half blood quill and half feather. This meant that the foundation crew could handle them safely, the chicks being robust enough for the process, and the humans relatively safe from beaks and talons. The chicks' feet were anatomically able with full talons, but they did not yet know how to use them defensively. I unclipped a zippered canvas chick bag from the carabiner on my climbing belt and reached for the hunched-down chick first. I folded its wings tight against its body and then inserted it headfirst, turning its body upright after the tail feathers cleared the mouth of the bag. I zipped the bag carefully, clipped it onto a rope, and carefully lowered the chick down through the branches. The second chick took more finesse. I uncurled a roll of stout wire from my fanny pack, bent one end into a hook, and slowly extended the wire across the nest and slid the hook around the chick's legs, gently pulling it into reach. I grabbed it, safely holding its wings and repeating the bagging and lowering process. Bruce shouted up, "All clear!" I would have 20 minutes or so before the ground crew would be done measuring, taking feather samples, and banding the chick, so I pulled myself up into the nest. I looked out at the view the eagles enjoyed every day and wondered how many humans have had such an opportunity. The floor of the nest where I sat was lined with soft grasses and a few white pine sprigs. It was clean. The chicks always back up to the edge of the nest to defecate, sending a stream of whitewash out and down to the forest floor. But there certainly was an aroma, fishy and sharp, and part of a northern park was draped over the sticks on the far side of the nest. I took a few moments to dig in the nest duff, looking to see if there were unhatched eggs, as I knew adult eagles often buried infertile ones. My brief survey complete, I turned my gaze farther afield. I could see water in every direction for miles, dotted with islands, wetlands, and stump fields. I could make out forest composition as well, glimmers of white peaked from paper birch stands. Young aspen glowed a brighter green, and the crowns of old-growth hemlock and pines stood dark green against the sky. I could even see a loon foraging on the lake below. I thought back to the first time I had seen an expansive view like this. I was only 14 years old, and I had climbed up the rickety ladder on the side of our silo at the family farm in Iowa. My brother and I wanted to raise a pigeon as a pet, and we had spotted a nest near the silo's rounded top. Climbing the silo was not something our parents would have approved, so our trembling legs were probably part fear at the exposed rusty ladder rungs, part fear of falling, and the certain knowledge that punishment might result from our escapade. But when we got to the top and carefully tucked one of the squabs into a jacket pocket, we hung there for a few minutes, taking in the panorama, fields, hedgerows, a far-off tractor working the land, topped by that expansive Iowa sky. A call from below brought me back. I had traveled a long journey from that Iowa silo to this eagle's nest in the north woods of Wisconsin, and it was time to get back to work. I started carefully pulling the chicks back up to their lofty home. There would be time for recollections when my feet were back on the ground. And that's the prologue. This book is called Wrong Tree. He goes on in the first chapter to talk about his childhood on that farm, having all kinds of wildlife as pets. He had foxes as pets, raccoons, skunks. He was involved in the farming as soon as his legs got long enough to drive the tractor, and of course off on adventures with his siblings. One of those great wild kind of childhoods. He went on to work for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and the part I'm going to read to you today is about the late 1970s when he is, I think his title is wildlife technician, doing all kinds of very athletic and difficult, long, hot days, working on everything from bears to doing sharp-tailed grouse surveys and a huge variety of work. But he has an interesting part here dealing with beavers, doing a lot of beaver damage work. And they did a lot of relocating of beavers even back in the 1970s. The chapter is called Nature's Engineers, Friend or Foe? And the Confucius quote at the beginning of this chapter, Choose a job you love and you will never have to work another day of your life. It starts out. My mother told this story about my high school graduation in 1969. After the ceremony, a group of friends and neighbors were invited to the farm for coffee and cake, which was customary back then. I hung around the living room for a while and greeted everyone. But like most 18-year-olds, I was aching to celebrate with my peers. So after what I deemed a decent show of visiting, I slipped out, leapt into my car, and was off to go to other parties and hang out with my friends. After I left, Mom said, talk among the adults turned to the obvious subject, what's Jeff going to do now? Mom replied, well, we don't think he's interested in farming. Jeff is interested in a career in wildlife conservation. Two of the men in the group, the sheriff, who was a neighbor, and the local veterinarian, looked at each other and said, yeah, we figured so. What do you mean? Mom said. How did you know? Sheriff Grant spoke first. Every night after school, I see him tramping across the fields and sloughs with his shotgun hunting pheasants and rabbits. Then in the morning, he's back out there heading for the creek with a pack basket of muskrat traps. Doc spoke next. I do vet work on over 100 farms, and nowhere other than here do I pull into the yard and see tame raccoons sitting on the porch or a red fox running around the yard, let alone a kid walking a descended skunk on a leash in the 4th of July parade. Look around here. He's got cages full of rabbits, a chicken coop with over 5 species of pigeons, and then there's the turtles, snakes, you name it. Look at the cattle water tank. It's got channel catfish in it. Then in the fall, the barn's full of muskrat, fox, and raccoon pelts. He spends all his time hunting, fishing, and trapping. If he goes to college, what did you think he was going to major in? Accounting? Oh, I see your point, Mom said. Now I'll go on to his beginning his career in wildlife in northern Wisconsin. And he's going to talk about a trap called a Bailey beaver trap, and it leaves the beavers uninjured so that they can move them. So he'll describe the trap. The trap we used was called the Bailey beaver trap and was made in Tomahawk, Wisconsin. The Bailey had 2 big clamshell-like jaws made of mesh wire so that when a beaver swam over and bumped its T-bar-shaped trigger, the release of the trigger would cause the jaws to spring shut, and the beaver would be caught inside unharmed. The trap was designed to be set in about 6 inches of water to conceal it from the beaver. It was big, clumsy, and awkward to carry, especially with a 40-pound beaver in it. But Jack, that's his boss, was an expert with them, and he taught me all the tricks. Jack even invented his own trigger modification that reduced misfires and improved trap efficiency. One morning, Jack approached me and said something had come up. I have to haul our bulldozer to Pershing Wildlife Area. Can you run the beaver trap line alone? Sure, I said. Let's see. We've got 5 Baileys set, and with that new complaint called in last night, I'll take 2 more empty traps and hit the road. Jack said, great, I'll help you load up. Take my truck so you'll have 4-wheel drive. Now, Jack's truck was a 1974 Chevy 4x4 short box with a bumper winch mounted on the front. I loved it. It really looked cool, and Jack thought so too, and it was probably the only state truck ever to have gotten washed and waxed regularly. After we got the 2 Baileys loaded, there wasn't a lot of extra room for the cages we used to transport the live beaver to the relocation sites where they wouldn't cause trouble. We decided that with only 5 Baileys set, the odds were that I would catch 3 beaver at the most. We never had 100% success with the Baileys, and 2 Baileys and 3 cages perfectly filled up the truck box. Standard protocol was if a beaver was caught in a Bailey, we would turn it on its side and squish the mesh down, compressing the beaver so one of its ears stuck out through the mesh. Then while kneeling on the mesh, we could pull out the tag clippers and grab the beaver's ear and clip a numbered tag to it. This tagging was part of a study looking into whether translocated beavers stayed in the area where they were released, dispersed to new areas, or tried to return home. Eventually, we learned that of the dozens of beaver Jack and I translocated, all the tag returns from fur trappers were near the release site. No beaver had returned to the original locations. Of the 272 beaver transplanted to lakes and potholes, their mean straight-line distance after being released was 2.0 miles. After the beaver was ear-tagged, we would transfer it to the cage and then transport the cage to the truck. Other than a lot of huffing and some teeth clicking, beavers usually settled down and were quite docile in a cage or trap. Traps are terrible for transporting beaver, as the beaver can bite you through the large mesh. The bulky Baileys could also catch on the brush, sometimes fall over in the truck, allowing the safety clips to come apart and the beaver to escape. So off I went with Jack's truck, loaded with two traps and three cages. My first stop was at the new site where I set two traps. My next stop was at a damaged site with two already set traps, and much to my surprise, we'd caught two beaver. I transferred them to the two cages and headed down the road. My third stop, another damaged site with two more traps, had two more beaver, so I filled my remaining cage, but had an extra beaver. I looked around. The test holes we'd created in the dams the day before had been repaired, so I needed to reset the Bailey traps. I was in a bind. I sat down and thought for a bit. I couldn't transport a beaver loose in the truck bed because it could easily jump out. What if it rode in the cab with me? This might be the point where a person with a normal fear of wildlife would take a common sense approach, but caution, aka common sense, has never been my forte. I took the smallest beaver, which weighed about 30 pounds, picked it up by the tail and tossed it into the cab and slammed the door. I quickly reset the Bailey trap and ran back to the truck. The beaver had jammed itself half under the seat but was too big to get farther underneath. I slipped quickly into the driver's seat and started down the road. The beaver did some scratching, but I didn't think it could damage the vinyl seats or the floor of the truck. I had about an hour's drive to the next site, and after about 10 minutes, the beaver backed out from under the seat and hissed at me. I started talking to it in a soft voice, kind of like you would talk to a nervous horse. The beaver appeared to respond and started to relax and look around inquisitively. All this time, I was clutching and shifting gears right next to the beaver and trying to keep my eyes on the road and the beaver at the same time. To my horror, after a few miles, out of the corner of my eye, I saw him start to nibble on the vinyl seat. In a deep voice, I shouted, "No!" like I was scolding a dog. He stopped and obeyed. I started the quiet talking again, and to my amazement, he pulled himself up on the seat and looked out the window. Now we were having a great time. There I was, driving down the road with the beaver sitting next to me, staring out the window, moving his head from side to side, enjoying the countryside. I pulled up to the last trap site, and you guessed it, there was another beaver. 5 out of 5 for 100% trap success rate. We'd never seen that before, and we never did again. This beaver was a little smaller, about 20 pounds, and after I tagged him, I just opened the truck door and tossed him in. I had only driven a short distance when the fight began. With both beaver hissing and false charging each other and causing quite a ruckus, the first beaver stayed on the seat and the new beaver tried getting under the seat and even up under the dash. I started yelling again and they both froze. They must have figured I was the alpha beaver because they established a truce of sorts with one on the bench seat and the other on the floor. I only had about 20 miles to go before I got to the release site on the Flambeau River. When we got there, I pulled up close to the water, turned off the truck, went around and opened the passenger door. Beaver number 2 jumped right out and waddled straight for the river. Then beaver number 1, on the seat, carefully backed down onto the floorboard, peered out the door, slid to the ground, and followed his comrade to the water. The other 3 beaver in the back of the truck were easily released from their cages. It was then, when I got back into the truck cab, that the smell hit me. The scientific name for beaver is Castor canadensis. The French name for beaver is Castor, with the accent on the last syllable, Castor. They are named for 2 special glands called the castors, which are located at the base of their tail. They also have 2 oil sacs located next to the castors. They deposit secretions from the castor glands and mark their home turf by constructing little mud mounds throughout their territory and squeezing some castor on each one. This warns other beavers to stay out or be prepared for a fight. Beaver also secrete the oil from their oil sacs and comb it into their fur to repel water. I always save the oil and castor from my winter trap line to dry and grind to make a scent lure to use each season. The lure, along with some fresh aspen sticks placed in front of traps, would ideally entice the beaver to swim into the trap. Castor scent from a foreign colony really gets a beaver riled up and can be used to induce them to climb up on that mud mound and deposit some of their own castor. Beaver castor is quite valuable even today. At one time in the 90s, it sold for close to $100 a pound for trapping lure. But also as an agent in expensive fragrances, the perfume industry breaks down the chemicals in castor and extracts the ingredients that give perfume its staying power. The castor extracts are combined with flower oils and then sold in fancy glass bottles on the shelves of salons, in, for instance, Revlon's Chanel No. 9. Google beaver castor, you'll find it used in dozens of products, including cigarette tobacco and ice cream. The castor chemicals were working well that day because Jack's truck reeked of musky beaver. When I pulled into the Park Falls DNR shop, it was after working hours, so everyone had gone home. I went inside, got a 5-gallon bucket, mixed up a cocktail of pine sol, dish soap, toilet bowl cleaner, and bleach. I grabbed a scrub brush and went to work. Thankfully, trucks did not have carpet in those days, and the floorboards slanted toward the doors. So I put a spray nozzle on the water hose and went right inside the cab and gave it the works. After I was satisfied that most of the odor was gone, I found some rags and dried everything, and then parked it with the windows down and went home exhausted. The next morning, Jack asked how everything had gone yesterday. I said, "Great, we caught 5 beaver. He never asked for details, and I never provided them, and he never mentioned anything about the truck. It smelled great. So I'll stop there. I'll find some more stories written by Jeff Wilson in a book called Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.